Welcome to Right Spokane Perspective with your host, Tim.
And Shannon.
It's opinion, fact, information, and your alert system. Stay tuned and enjoy the show. And welcome to Right Spokane Perspective. Talking about education, we have Chad Mogandaz on with us today. He is a candidate for OSPI. You can check him out at voteforchad.com. That's vote4chad.com. We'll jump into that conversation after inspiration.
Our inspiration today is missing the basics. For decades, McDonald's ruled fast food with their famous Quarter Pounder burger. In the 1980s, a rival chain cooked up an idea to dethrone the company with the Golden Arches. A&W offered the third-pound burger, larger than McDonald's, and sold it for the same price. Even more, A&W's burger won numerous blind taste tests. But the burger bombed. Nobody bought it. Eventually, they dropped it from the menu. Research revealed that consumers misunderstood the math and thought the third-pound burger was smaller than the quarter burger. A grand idea failed because people missed the basics. Jesus warned of how easy it is to miss the basics. Religious leaders, scheming to trap and discredit him during the week he was crucified, posed a strange, hypothetical scenario about a woman who was widowed seven times. Jesus responded, insisting that this knotty dilemma wasn't a problem at all. Rather, their problem was how they didn't know the scriptures or the power of God. The scriptures, Jesus insisted, aren't first intended to answer logical or philosophical puzzles. Rather, their primary aim is to lead us to know and love Jesus and to have eternal life in him. These are the basics the leaders missed. We often miss the basics too. The Bible's main aim is an encounter with the living Jesus. It would be heartbreaking to miss it. Heavenly Father, sometimes we get lost even amid good things. Please help us to stay on track. In Jesus' name, amen.
That's interesting inspiration today. And I'm going to have to say amen to that because we're talking about education and what a simple fraction does on a menu. And that was a profound thing that I studied in business. And people just didn't see that the third pounder was more than the quarter pounder just because they saw the three was a smaller number than the four. Very simple mistake by the public, but I guess a simple mistake by the corporations not recognizing how uneducated the public is or how they could be fooled by such a simple thing sitting on the menu. Anyhow, we have Chad Mogandaz in with us today. He is running for OSPI. I want to see how he breaks down the fractions for hamburgers today. We're going to be talking about public schools, but first off, we just want to figure out who Chad Mogandaz is. So thanks for coming on the show today, Chad.
Oh, my pleasure, Tim. I had the same reaction when I go through the checkout line. Now, quite often I'll have change. It's like, you know, $2.95. I'll give a $5 bill and a nickel to the cashier, and they give me this strange look, like why did you give me a nickel? And these are little things that, you know, we take for granted, having, you know, worked with change all our lives, but it's not something that they overtly learn in schools these days. And so we're ill preparing them for, you know, just basic entry-level jobs like being a cashier.
Or even maybe being a customer ordering a hamburger.
Exactly.
Like, in the, you know, third pounder versus a quarter pounder. Third pounder is a better deal. And we just, it seems like we've shortcutted ourselves very simply like that in education. But so who is Chad Mogandaz? What have you done with your life? And, you know, basically your history leading up to this point of running for office.
I was a military brat. I grew up all over the place, but mainly in upstate New York. That's where I went to college up there. I met my wife at Cornell University and then went into the Navy with an ROTC scholarship. So I was a nuclear submarine officer for a while and then went into high tech for 20 years and started volunteering for my local PTA as an education advocate. And then I was on the school board in the Issaquah School District and then the president of the school board there. We were the 15th largest school in the state, and I soon realized that all the really important decisions were being made where the money was being spent. And so on the day that the Supreme Court announced its ruling on the McCleary case, I announced my candidacy for the state legislature because I wanted to be part of that solution. So I went down to Olympia, and oh, did I get my wish very quickly. within a year, I was a ranking member of the House Education Committee, and I was one of the lead negotiators for the McCleary remedy and, you know, a series of commissions and working groups and eventually co-chair of the oversight committee where we reported our progress to the Supreme Court. And eventually we increased state funding for schools by 105% over 8 years. And I was pretty happy with that result and expected to see some dramatic improvements in our student achievement. And that never happened. In fact, our national assessment scores have been steadily going down since then. Before COVID, you know, we saw half of kids not meeting standard in math. And then after COVID, that dropped to 1/3. And a lot of people saying, well, it's going to rebound quickly. Well, it's rebounded to 39%. And so now we're struggling with enrollment decline because parents got a little window into their kids' classrooms during COVID, you know, probably on their laptop. And then a lot of them didn't like what they saw. And so across the state, 4% enrollment drop. And in my district, the 10%, we actually just closed two schools last year. And I've been teaching in the Bellevue School District for the last 5 years, full-time as a computer science teacher. And so I think in Bellevue, parents just have more options and the resources to consider those options. And they voted with their feet.
Yeah, they sure did. Yeah, we saw it
and
statewide.
As a teacher, I've been seeing the impact of these policies in the classroom firsthand. And I was content to just retire after my two terms and just be a happy teacher into my gray years. And when I started seeing these policies come down, particularly the one that required us to deceive parents about the names and genders that kids were using inside the classroom.
You're talking about House Bill 1599.
Yeah. So there's actually a policy, a 3211 model policy that was developed by the Superintendent's Public Instruction's Office and WASDA, the Washington School Directors Association, that says that it's dangerous if we were to share this kind of information with parents. This presumption of guilt really has bothered me because I'm a very strict constitutionalist, and I know Supreme Court has ruled that parents have a fundamental right to the care, custody, and control of their children, and the government shall not impair that right unless and until the parents are deemed unfit. And there's a due process for that. It's not like we can just assume every parent is unfit. So that was what basically got me involved in politics again, because I didn't see a lot of people who had my experience at the state, district, and the local classroom level. And I think that's the perspective that we need to take going forward. The policies have been coming down that have distracted us from our core mission of academic achievement, you know, 21st century career skills and basic civics, which is what I think everybody can agree our schools should be offering. But they're not doing very well on that because they've been distracted by a lot of partisan stuff.
Well, and a lot of students, a lot of the public, actually, this is not a new problem. It's been going on for decades in our public school system. And so a lot of adults don't realize not only that a third pounder burger is bigger than a quarter pounder, but also they don't understand how our government works. They don't understand a representative republic. They don't understand that the executive, I mean, we all vote for president as if he's going to change the world. Well, I mean, you just need an executive branch to follow the law. The laws are created by elected representatives. And when we talk about public schools, a lot of people thought, well, you know, the local school boards are doing the trick. Well, really, a lot of the mandates come from Olympia, and the local school boards don't really have that much control. But I think more people would like to see control at the local school boards. And parents were infuriated during COVID, seeing not just what their children weren't learning, but got to see some of the things that they were learning with, you know, DEI. I call it DIE because it's how all civilizations die. But this diversity, equity, and inclusion, where we're dividing students amongst each other rather than having them work together to succeed in the classroom.
Exactly. And the inclusion that I like to focus on is the kind of inclusion that helped us through two terms where the legislature had a divided control. We had to find common ground. And that exercise is an important exercise that everyone should be doing if you're in a government position, because, you know, we provide services that are effectively a monopoly. And so in order for it to be inclusive and in order for every family to feel comfortable sending their kids to a public school, we need to make sure that we're not doing divisive things. And as you mentioned, you know, DEI and a lot of the new policies with, you know, transgender ideology have been very divisive.
Well, and didn't the legislature just pass a bill that would compel local school districts to integrate into their curriculum, I think, pretty radical things like queer history and LGBTQIA plus 2S. I can't keep track of all the rest. But they want all of that in the curriculum when our children are struggling in the basic areas. They don't need that confusion in a lot of people's views.
No, I completely agree. And I think what a lot of people don't realize about that particular bill is it gives superintendent of public instruction an inordinate amount of power. Already the superintendent of public instruction, you know, a nonpartisan statewide position, has control of the purse strings for most of the state budget, because most of the money spent by the state actually goes to our schools, and sets policies for 295 school districts and over a million kids. And so this particular bill gives them, gives the OSPI, the Office of State Superintendent of Public Instruction, quite a bit of control over the funding that goes to each individual school district. If they're not complying, he can cut funding.
Well, and we saw that with the COVID mandates, and actually on this show we talked about it with the a number of people that were running for school board and also elected officials, because it was a mandate, whether your school had a COVID issue or not. It was mask and vaccine and, you know, all of these mandates. And then they, Chris Reichdell, normally I pronounce it with a heavier Reichdell, was very, very heavy handed and threatened to cut funding to the local schools.
Oh, yeah. And he was even threatening their director's insurance for the school boards, so that if they brought kids back to school and anything went wrong, they would be personally liable.
It seemed like that threat went totally against the McCleary decision itself.
Well, yeah. When we were negotiating McCleary, I went through a lot of effort to, first of all, make sure that the funding was following the students. So if students leave to go someplace else, the districts would lose that funding. And then secondly, to make sure districts had as much local control as possible. And there were a few categorical funding items like class size reduction and things like that. For the most part, the district has control over the finances. And we didn't realize at the time that the superintendent of public instruction had this kind of power to withhold funding, because this was, set aside with the budget, with a state statute that was done by the legislature. We didn't think he had that kind of control. So it never even occurred to us to put that into the McCleary solution, that it would be a decision made by the legislature and not by the executive branch. But that's how the constitutional lawyers have come out after COVID, saying that he does have this control. And I think a lot of people were surprised by it.
Well, I think a lot of people would probably like to see the law changed. And obviously there's tens of thousands of students' parents that decided that that amount of control and what was going on in the schools wasn't appropriate, because they've chosen other educational models outside of the public schools. And so we're going to have to go off into a break here in a minute, but school choice, what's, the idea behind that? Is that, I know that there's a lot of people talking about that, within school districts, statewide systems, or what's the new educational models that they're doing, the public
vouchers, things like that.
Yes. Well, there's the vouchers, but there's also this alternative schools.
The charter schools?
The charter schools,
Charter schools. So I was actually the prime sponsor in the House for the charter schools fix in 2016. And that was also validated by the Supreme Court in 2018, along with the McCleary decision. And I've always been a fan of school choice. I think parents should be in control, just as customers are in control in a free market. The state, the way it's so dominated by the teachers union right now, I won't expect that we'll have a voucher system or something like that anytime soon. But we did try to blaze the trail for that by making sure that the funding was following the student. Now, right now, it follows the student between public schools. But potentially, in the future, that could follow the student to, a homeschool situation or a private school as well.
Well, I think as the schools in, obviously statewide with the control of Chris Reichdell, but, if there's local control given more broadly for curriculums, as parents see that some of these ideologies being pushed in schools are almost religious and maybe violate the Blaine Amendment. So again, we are here with Chad Magandaz running for OSPI. He's going to be leading the public schools if he gets elected. So check him out, voteforchad.com. So Chad, we were talking about, obviously schools and curriculum and maybe school choice, but parents have decisions to make putting their children in school, but voters also have decisions to make. The McCleary decision was basically a lawsuit saying the Constitution says that the state shall fund the students, but we're now seeing a moving away from that again and seeing more and more local levies and bonds that are supporting the schools. And as that creeps back up, are we going to have another McCleary decision? I mean, we're at $20,000 a student here in the area here in Spokane.
Yeah, there's definitely the risk of that. In fact, if you look historically, there was an initial decision back in the 70s called the Duran decision. It was very similar to the McCleary decision. They ended up going back again, and they had a Duran 2. So are we looking at a McCleary 2 decision? Potentially. In fact, a lot of what we did for the McCleary remedy, first of all, we prioritized funding for education, which is kind of a no-brainer, I think. But then we did this thing called the levy swap, where we took levy authority that was available for local school districts, and we moved that to the state. And that was considered to be a more equitable solution because the state would have the same mill rate for all of the kids throughout the state. And it wouldn't depend on your zip code as much, you know, the amount of funding that your schools would get. And we limited the things you could spend local funding for as just pure enhancements to the state's program of basic education. So things like, you know, additional programs, additional time, not part of the basic ed. So typically not playing for salaries. Okay. But what we're seeing is that there's a lot of lobbying going on so that, you know, school districts can have special dispensation to collect more money than they were expected when we leveled everybody at the same mill rate. And that's creating inequities again.
Well, and we saw that the, you know, our homes, the prices went through the roof over the last several years. And so with those assessed values going up, we're paying a lot more in those bonds and levies. Is that right?
Yeah, even at the same mill rate, we capped the mill rate. But as the property values go up, the actual numbers go up, even if they're the same percentage.
So we're spending a ton of money. And I don't know statewide what all of the bonds look like, but I think there was a lot of failure in the school bonds. And it used to be that the levies would have to pass at the same threshold as the bonds. So a lot of levies passed, but the bonds didn't pass. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on just the process. Should the levies have a higher threshold like the bonds? And do you think parents and taxpayers said no to the bonds because our schools look way overbuilt and way overpriced when we just need children to be educated? We need a structure, not a Taj Mahal.
Yeah, I think it's more than that. I think they look at the stats and see that we now have the highest compensated teaching staff in the entire nation. And a lot of districts, when they got the additional money from McCleary, they bargained it all away in their local collective bargaining agreements. And so we ended up with very well-compensated teachers. And so it's hard to argue
that. A lot of people don't realize that. A lot of people don't realize that we have teachers that, because they have a master's degree, even though they're only teaching kindergarten or fourth grade, they're making more money than most anyone in a lot of the districts across the state. As far as, you know, if you're a plumber, if you're, you know, a laborer, like in our school district here, some of these middle school teachers or elementary teachers are making double the typical average wage. So you're looking at a six-figure teacher. Is it worth $120,000 for a teacher to teach kindergarten?
And we have a regionalization factor that's supposed to compensate for the local labor market, but it's not as big as it should be. When we were looking at the analysis of what the median household values were, for example, in all the different school districts, we had some districts that had median household values over $1 million. And you can probably guess where those were. But then we also had school districts where the median household values were in the 20s. It's wow. A really dramatic difference depending on where you are, how much it costs to live in those areas. And so the regionalization factor, I think, needs some tweaking. We've got, you know, rural areas where teachers are, you know, paid double what your median salary is for that area. And then you have areas, you know, where frankly, the cost of living is so high that teachers just can't possibly afford to live in that area. And so they're commuting from, you know, 2-3 districts away.
Yeah, and that makes it hard, I think, on the students. It makes it hard on the staff. And I think it makes it hard on the taxpayers to realize, you know, obviously if a teacher is driving a Mercedes-Benz and lives in a $2 million home and they're making, you know, what the, you know, half the neighborhood is making, it kind of makes tension, I think, for the people that have to pay for those positions. And I'm not against teachers at all.
It's not even considering the fact that they're only working 36 weeks a year, 180 days. And not many people get that kind of vacation time.
No.
If you actually figure out how much I'm making as a teacher now compared to what I was making in the tech sector, and I worked for Microsoft for over 20 years, I'm actually, if you figure out per hour, I'm actually making more as a teacher now than I was in the tech sector.
Yeah, and that might unsettle a lot of taxpayers that are working overtime just to try to make ends meet. And, you know, they see teachers that are bugging out of there right at 3 o'clock expecting that they're not going to have to stay later to talk to parents. Because I know that the parent-teacher conference and connection with teachers sometimes is rough. I know that there's, you know, those collective bargaining, the union, very strict rules on when teachers can do certain things. But it seems like the Office of Public Instruction should be telling the legislature how better our state laws could operate so that good teachers can take that extra time if they want to, right?
Yeah. And the other thing that we could do is, you know, consider performance. We're not allowed to consider performance in salaries right now. And I would not even allowed to consider the needs of the district. So, for example, we have chronic shortages in areas like special education. You know, we can't give them anything more in salary to entice more people to go into that field where it's desperately needed. Same for computer science teachers. You know, we have many states in the union who have adopted computer science graduation requirements. And yet we haven't because we can't hire enough computer science teachers. And that's even with the last year and all of the tech workers who were laid off in the last year who could have easily made a transition to pay it forward to the next generation and take their knowledge and pass it off in a classroom. We created programs like the TEALS program when I was on the school board in Issaquah that allow us to bring in industry experts to teach with teachers. But I actually came in through that program. I was a volunteer just to kind of eat my own dog food for that. And then I started doing some substitute teaching. And then next thing you know, I was hired and working on my certification as well. And I'd love to see more people encouraged to, you know, basically pass their knowledge off to the next generation. But we can't do it because of a lot of limitations we have on being able to differentiate pay.
Yeah, and that is something that I think a lot of fields in government are struggling with. Well, even in the private sector, is finding qualified people and then also, you know, attracting those qualified people to specific positions. And some of that, I think, is probably the teachers union that put some blockades on the feasibility on taking some of those measures and putting them into practice. What are your thoughts on the operations of OSPI? I know that the state legislature has mandates on the school system statewide. There's an online schooling district statewide. There's the educational service districts. You know, what's your thought about the administrative side, the function of OSPI, and, you know, maybe a switch from that, I would say, cost-heavy administration to getting the money into the classrooms at the local school district level?
And I've always been one to prioritize putting the money in the classrooms whenever possible. And you know, one of the things that I did when I was president of the Issaquah School Board is we made sure we had the lowest administrative overhead in any district in King County. We had the lowest cost per square foot for new construction. We had the best credit rating. We made sure, and we went 10 full years without a single finding in our state audits. Those are the kind of things that reassure the public that you're being good stewards of the tax dollars and allowed us to be passing, you know, bonds and levies with over 70% support while just everyone around us was failing it during the Great Recession. You had mentioned the districts having trouble passing bonds and levies right now. And the push we're getting in Olympia is to lower the threshold for bond passage, which is actually in the Constitution. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that's a long-term commitment. It needs a higher threshold for the local community to buy into that because it's not just a temporary thing that's only going to be lasting a year or two. Like a levy would be.
Now, what are your thoughts on the levy?
The founders intentionally made that tougher. Yeah.
Do you think because of the McCleary decision and this educational cost creep that we're seeing with the levies, do you think that the levies and bonds should both have that threshold?
I would say that the levies are fine where they are right now. The bonds, definitely. But the levies, as they're set right now, post-McCleary, the levies only should be being used for perks, basically, additions to the state's system of basic education. So if you want to enhance it with, you know, additional programs, if you want to have more time, you want to have more hours, those are the kind of things you can fund locally. And so I would argue that if those don't pass, it's not the end of the world. I mean, you still got the state's program of basic education.
Oh, okay.
And these enhancements, by definition, should not be required.
So the enhancements you're talking about, they threaten art class, music class, special education. Those were kind of the things that they said would go by the wayside if they didn't pass here locally.
Yeah, that's a little disingenuous. For example, special education is a federal program, and that's a law. They have to satisfy the special education requirements. And then you could go and look at the original bill that was passed. It was called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA. And, there are some problems with how that's being implemented. So, for example, the federal government's portion of funding was supposed to be 40%. And right now, I think it's hanging out around 13%. And so they've been quite a bit short on their contribution to special education funding. And we can talk about how the remainder should be made up. Right now, the remainder mostly falls on the districts to do that. And that's probably not as equitable as it should be. But, okay. Things like music programs are actually part of the system, the state's system of basic education. So that's included as part of basic ed. It just may not be some of the additional programs like after school activities, things like that.
Okay. So obviously the bonds, those are our levy issues. The bonds are more about the buildings. Those have failed. I think a lot of people are disgusted with the glamour that we're seeing built in our schools when we're looking for educational outcomes, not big common areas or, 60,000 foot, entry areas that we have to pay to heat throughout all of the school year or the rest of the year with the kids aren't even in the school. But what are your thoughts on institutionalizing healthcare in education, like the school-based health clinics and of course, children at all ages with certain medical desires having to do with identity. And then, of course, after age 13, children can make medical decisions on their own and having those school-based health clinics. Do you think that that's a rub between parents and schools? And what's your thoughts about that?
No, absolutely. First of all, we've got a lot of mission creep with our schools to begin with. We need to focus on the essentials. But some of these other areas, I think they're built on faulty assumptions when it comes to the constitutionality of what they're doing. So, for example, having clinics inside of schools, there is an assumption there that a child can make their own medical decisions, which I don't believe is correct. This is based on this thing called the mature minor doctrine. And we have a system for children being able to kind of leapfrog the age 18 majority requirement. It's called an emancipated minor. And you go to a court and you make your case, and the court can grant you majority status even if you're not 18 yet. But the mature minor doctrine allows a practitioner, a doctor or a PA or someone like that, to look at a student and say, well, this is a very mature student. I think the student is perfectly capable of deciding whether they want to go on puberty blockers or get an abortion or things like that. And I think that's in direct conflict with the Roughton decision from 2000 that says that parents have the fundamental right to direct care and custody and control of their children.
Well, I think that's definitely going to be an issue that you're going to be bumping into as a candidate for OSPI. And I think OSPI is going to be facing some of those legal challenges in the very, very near future with, like you say, the mission creep that we see in the educational industrial complex. And it's a lot of money that we're spending on education, and we're looking for good outcomes for children educationally. And I think healthcare is definitely a separate decision. And of course, we have lots of healthcare in Washington State that's out there for parents and for students, and there's subsidy programs. And so it does seem inappropriate for a lot of people that I talk to have those. Obviously, a school nurse to throw a Band-Aid on a knee that hit the field a little hard is appropriate. But beyond that, I think a lot of people would not be in support of that. Well, we're out of time for today's show, but I want to thank Chad Mogendahs for coming on. Thanks again for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tim.
Again, folks, voteforchad.com. Check out all the candidates. We do these shows for you. We do not receive any funding from any candidates. We are funded by you, the listeners, and we want to continue to provide you information about candidates to share with family and friends so we can make informed decisions come August when the primary happens, and in November for the general. We'll be with you folks again tomorrow.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Right Spokane Perspective. We are sponsored by Right Spokane Perspective LLC and made possible by advertisers you hear and contributions from listeners like you.